Hello, Alex Zane here. Thank you for choosing to listen to Just the Facts. And while you can still enjoy these episodes forever, you might want to check out our brand new show, A Trip to the Movies, where each week a different famous film fan curates their perfect night out at the cinema, picking what snacks they'd eat, where they'd sit, who they'd go with, and of course, what movies they'd screen. If you love cinema as much as we do, search A Trip to the Movies with Alex Zane or head to our socials at Trip to Movies Pod. That's at Trip to Movies Pod to find out more.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, I'm Alex Zane and welcome to episode 28 of Just the Facts, the podcast that features a conversation about the career and achievements of a different actor or filmmaker every week. Don't forget, you can find us across all social media at JTFpod, Instagram, Twitter, all social media. And if you want to watch the video of today's interview, you can find it on our JTFpod YouTube channel. It'll be out the Friday after the podcast is released. So my guest today is someone I was very, very, very excited to have on. As some of you may know, I am a huge Jaws fan. It is my favourite film of all time. And currently on stage in the West End of London is a fantastic play called The Shark is Broken. It's about the relationship of the three leads in the film, Roy Scheider, Richard Dreyfuss and Robert Shaw, and the way they interacted behind the scenes during their frequent downtime when The Shark infamously failed to work as intended. Playing the late great Robert Shaw in the play is his son, Ian Shaw, who is my guest today and who was absolutely lovely. We talked about his memories of his father, what it's like playing him on stage, as well as, obviously, plenty of Jaws chat. If you love the movie as much as I do, I think you're really going to enjoy this episode, and I cannot recommend the play enough. It's proved so successful. It has just had its run extended to the 13th of February next year at the Ambassador's Theatre in London. The Shark is Broken. So, without further ado, please welcome to episode 28 of Just the Facts, the brilliant Ian Shaw. Ian, lovely to have you on the show. How are you?
I'm very well. Yeah, very happy to be back and working again, you know.
You mean after the pandemic or just in general?
Well, in general, I suppose, but definitely after the pandemic, you know, it was, everyone was in the same boat, but it was a little bit depressing when the West End was shut down like that.
You're at the theatre right now, aren't you?
I am, yes. Apologies if there's drilling outside, but yes, I'm in the green room.
So this is the Ambassador's Theatre in London's lovely West End. How come you're there so early? I mean, I say so early. I haven't done a theatre production. Perhaps you're late, but it's 3 p.m. You've got a show this evening.
We have a show this evening. We also, on Mondays, like to just do a little speed run of various bits of the play, also to incorporate the understudies who have the unenviable task of going on should anything happen to any of the principals.
Has that happened? Have the understudies been called on yet? I always wonder whether they're sort of like, oh my God, I've got to do it, or they're like chomping at the bit for one of you to take a fall.
I think it's a bit of both, you know. It is. I've done it myself. It's a tough job. You're like a fireman or firewoman, whatever. And they haven't gone on, but they have done a performance of the piece, you know, to agents and to an invited audience, which I enjoyed enormously. It was quite strange watching the play.
I imagine. I was going to ask that question. So you're the only person, until we get to the understudy, who's obviously played your father playing Quint in the play. So what is it like watching someone else actually tackle that role?
It's very interesting, you know. I mean, I was just quite pleasantly surprised to see that the play works, you know, without me.
So I doing a sort of speed run on the Monday, this is just a once a week thing. You don't do it every day.
No, we just like to, you know, just refresh after a Sunday.
And it's not about adapting or anything. It's just making sure you're all still on point. You're not still fiddling with the play.
No, we're not at the moment. No, it's pretty much locked down. But it's also just to because what we do is we get the principals to, we have two runs, if you sort of mean. So one or two of the understudies will be working with one or two of the other actors so that they just get familiar with them.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, I guess I should have opened with this. So apologies for my tardiness, but congratulations. The Shark is Broken. I got to see it back in October. A fantastic play. Congratulations, mate.
Thank you.
Tell me, though, how does it feel? You've just had your run extended. That has got to be a nice bonus.
Yes, enormously gratifying. You know, it was a success in Edinburgh, but you're always a bit, I haven't been in this position before, but I was definitely a little nervous of what the London reception would be. So, you know, for it to be nicely reviewed and for people to want to see the show is incredibly gratifying, you know.
The reviews have been spectacular. And like I said, I mean, I loved it. And I think what I found about it, and I don't know whether you've seen this as well on the ground there, as it were, but it's got an appeal that goes beyond Jaws nerds like myself. Are you finding that people who might not be as familiar with the film and certainly the behind the scenes story are enjoying the play as well?
Yeah, I'm really loving that. I mean, Joseph Nixon, who's the co-writer with me, and I together, we were very conscious of trying to have our cake and eat it in a way, in that we felt that, you know, that the show had a sort of built-in audience to some degree, because we felt that if it was good enough, Jaws fans would want to come and see it. Mm. But we were also trying to, you know, write something that although it was inspired by Jaws, you know, didn't require any devotion to the film. I mean, I'm always slightly surprised when people haven't seen it. But, you know, of course, there are, you know, many, many, many people who haven't seen it. And it's been really amazing to get feedback from people who haven't seen the film, who really have enjoyed the play. But then I also feel that it feels like I'm sending them to Jaws as well. So I feel like Universal should be giving us a little cut of something.
Yeah, I mean, like you say, there is a huge awareness of Jaws. I found a crazy statistic that when it aired for the first time on British TV in 1981, 23.25 million people watched it, which the time was more than half the population of the UK sat down to watch Jaws when it first aired.
Goodness me, that's a great stat.
Yeah, it is. But I mean, and I'm sure you've heard this statement,
countless times since beginning the play, but Jaws is my favorite film of all time. You must have heard that a bit.
I've heard it a lot, you know, and I'm not that surprised. It is a fantastic film. I mean, I think that, you know, it really came together. Mm. They obviously didn't all think at the time that it was going to come together quite so well. But I mean, it was a hell of a collection of talented people. So that's a good start.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Both on
and off camera. I mean, an amazingly talented group of people. And as your play is testament to, happy accidents led to what could be considered a masterpiece of cinema, in my humble opinion. It is one of your favorite films as well, though, isn't it?
It is, very much so. Yeah.
What do you love about it?
I think I read a Pauline Kael review of it, and I really agreed with what she said, which is just that, you know, with a lot of thrillers and horror movies, you at some point feel like you know what's going to happen next. And I think Jaws is very good at, you know, not providing an easy way through. You're on the edge of your seat a lot of the time, because one moment it's very funny, and then the next moment it's genuinely heart-stopping. And it veers between all of these, you know, and sometimes it's quite lyrical as well. It's almost like they're on a sort of, it's like an adventure movie at times as well. And it's beautifully shot. I mean, I was just reading that, you know, Mike Chapman, who was the camera operator, obviously they had Bill Butler, who's a fantastic cinematographer, but Mike Chapman went on to do Taxi Driver and Raging Bull as a cinematographer. So he was, you know, an extraordinary talent as well. It felt like they had two cinematographers for the price of one. Mm. And so, yes, I mean, just to say that for me, it's like With Nail and I or something like that. It's endlessly quotable. There are so many gorgeous little scenes, you know. I mean, I love the one with, personally, I love the one with my dad when he's talking to Richard Dreyfuss about the shark cage, and then he sort of sings him into his grave with Farewell and Adieu, to Your Fair Spanish Ladies, because, you know, I think for the Shaw family, that reminds us of Robert and his wicked sense of humour more than anything, you know. It's a spoiler alert, but he wasn't a homicidal maniac as a father. He was very, very loving and funny.
It's a great scene, that scene. I do love that scene. I love so many of the scenes that your father shares as Quint with Richard Dreyfuss as Hooper. I'm a big fan of, you got city hands, Mr. Hooper, been counting money all your life. That's a great moment.
It is. There's a lot of good lines. I mean, Carl Gottlieb gets a little bit forgotten in this as well. I mean, I think that, you know, because I think Benchley's original script wasn't tremendous, and I think Robert wasn't thrilled at some of the dialogue, but I think Carl Gottlieb did a great job at making it funnier and polishing it up.
It's true, and I mean, we'll talk about it in a bit. The Indianapolis speech, which I think is obviously it's featured in the play, and there is an interesting story behind that. But first, I feel I should mention that you are currently, for those who are listening to this podcast, they'll be watching it as well. You are in your costume as Quint at the moment. Am I right?
No, I'm not. I am wearing a blue shirt.
Oh, okay. It's the green top with the blue shirt. The moustache is your own, though, right?
Yes. Well, it's eerily similar, actually. But no, it's not. It's just coincidence.
Okay. I just put two and two together. I didn't think, that's really nice. He's dressed up for the interview in character. I just assumed because you come off stage, you were still wearing the outfit. That's fine.
It's not quite the right green. No.
How close is the outfit in terms of authenticity that you wear in the play to the one from the film?
I think it's pretty darn close. I mean, the jacket
looks it.
The jacket. I mean, Duncan Henderson is our designer, and you know, is a stickler for details. He wouldn't settle for anything less. So you know, yeah, it is, as far as I'm aware, you know, the actual. I'm not quite sure what they call that jacket. I know. I think it's a sort of. I think it's a fairly standard issue U.S. Army jacket, but it has a number, and I'll have to look it up.
Well, it's an uncanny performance, and we'll talk about the performance shortly. First of all, just to go back to the writing side of it and the genesis of this play, what was the one thing that you and Joseph Nixon, your co-writer, spent the most time on? Was there something that you really wanted to get right more than anything else in telling this story?
I suppose we focused on the Indianapolis speech, it's sort of built around that speech to some degree. So, you know, and that was very interesting to us. Firstly, that Robert, you know, rewrote it, but then also that he got too drunk to perform it. You know, so and then obviously, you know, he called Stephen up, I think, at 2 o'clock in the morning and asked to do it again, begged to do it again. And Stephen obliged. And, you know, what you have on screen, I think, is something that, you know, is played endlessly. You know, if you look at YouTube, if you look at the USS Indianapolis speech on YouTube, mm-hmm. It's off the charts how many times it's been played. People just love it.
It's true. And people love it. And people love to sort of dissect the history of that, which you just touched on with your father rewriting it. Because there's so much conversation about the authorship of that speech, various people either being suggested as the writer of it or claiming they wrote it. Howard Sackler, Carl Gottlieb, John Milius, and indeed your father. Who do you attribute that speech to?
I think it's three of them. I mean, Carl talks about it, so he's not going to take credit for it. Howard Sackler came up with the idea, which is, I think he needs to be credited with that, because it you know, giving Quint the rationale for why he behaves as he does is, I think, very important to the film. Melius, you know, tried his best, I think, with a very lengthy speech. You know, I don't know precisely what the contribution he made was, but I'd be reluctant to, you know, not to give him credit. Mm. You know, what we have in the film is Robert's rewrite and a few additions of his own, but Robert didn't write it completely on his own. He didn't just sort of pluck it out of thin air. So I think, you know, it's three people. And, you know, Spielberg and Gottlieb would be given the credit for, you know, thinking, giving Robert, you know, permission to some degree to write it. I mean, obviously they did have respect for him because he was a novelist and a playwright.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think what's interesting to me is that even Robert's speech, I think most directors would consider problematic, because you've just got somebody talking for, you know, 3 minutes or whatever, and you're supposed to show these things in film and not tell them. But it does work, and I think that's also down to his performance. Yeah, it's a thing of beauty, I think.
It truly is. It truly is. It's an incredible speech and an incredible piece of cinema. Watching Robert Shaw deliver it as he does, I love it. In terms of researching the backstory to Jaws and the onset atmosphere and everything about that, obviously Carl Gottlieb's book. I forgot the name now. The Jaws Log. Yes, yeah. Thank you. Yes, The Jaws Log is just a wonderful book. Aside from that, where else did you draw on to find out what was actually going on behind the scenes.
There's a lot of material, you know. My own family kept a lot of press clippings of interviews by my father. There's documentaries that you can dig out, you know, on the end of Jaws DVDs or even just online. I suspect there will be, you know, there will continue to be documentaries because it seems to be a subject that isn't going away anytime soon. I also spoke to Virginia Shaw, who's my stepmother, who was there. And, you know, we were just sort of, and, you know, and Carl Gottlieb's The Jaws Log was instrumental as well. I mean, not everything, it's not a documentary, the play, though. There isn't, you know, you have to, there is some dramatic license in there. But we felt that it was, I suppose, spiritually true is the phrase I would use.
Yes. And I think that's it's a very important point. And I think that's the fantastic thing is it is a play in its own right that obviously, like I said, for Jaws nuts like me, also ticks a lot of boxes that we love. But you actually visited the set. Now, I'm assuming you weren't taking notes because you were about 6 years old going, this would make a great play in the future. But do you remember much about your time on set? Was it exciting or was it just people sitting around?
I remember that day very clearly because I met Bruce, who was the shark, you know, and I found that quite frightening.
I imagine. Yeah, it's a terrifying model.
It was. Yeah. So I didn't know how privileged I was. You know, I was just a little kid. I also remember seeing Stephen and liking him. Because he didn't seem like the other adults. He just seemed a bit, well, he was quite young and sort of, and very friendly. And he was sort of hopping about with a Super 8 camera in my memory. I have wondered, does he have lots of home footage of that he's never released? I don't know.
Gosh. That would be, that's an appetite whetter if ever I heard one. I wonder. I don't suppose you saw Craig Kingsbury. I've always wanted to know, like, what your father's relationship was like with Craig Kingsbury, the man who obviously plays Ben Gardner in the film, who I think he spent a lot of time with, didn't he, in terms of formulating his own Quint?
He did. And I think Craig was very, very useful. To give it that authenticity. I don't know anything about that beyond that. I know that Robert did spend a lot of time with him and they drank together. And you can feel it, you know, in the script, all the salty, you know, dialogue that Quint has, comes from a real place. And yes. So, I mean, I think that was a great decision that they made to pair those two together.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny when you sort of see Ben Gardner on screen played by Craig and you're like, oh, my gosh, he even looks a lot like Quint. It's a funny resemblance they've got going there. Although I guess in terms of the play, the biggest thanks should go to Bob Matty, the special effects guy who built Bruce, who had this wonderful, sort of, by all accounts, from reading around him, he was a guy who had this can-do attitude. He was like, sure, I did the squid in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. I'll build you a shark that'll work in the ocean, just to then find out just how cruel the sea could be to a pneumatic shark. So without his failure to deliver a working shark, we might not be here talking about the play.
I know, extraordinary, isn't it? That... I mean, I think some of the younger viewers think that it's not terribly good, but at the time it looked extraordinary, I think. And other tricky thing about sharks is that they don't look very real in themselves anyway. You know, they've got some, like he says in the speech, black eyes, you know, lifeless eyes like a doll's eyes. And so that's an extra difficulty. I was reading somewhere that it cost like $250,000 to make. and more than twice that to operate, you know, which at the time, you know, was a big budget. And how they like painted it with this strange sort of sandpapery paint to make the water run off as it would do on a shark. Yeah, so those guys are amazing. I'm in awe of technical people generally on film sets, but Bob Matty, you know, Joe Alves, all those people did an extraordinary job. Apart from the fact that it didn't bloody work.
But as well as, obviously, this is your latest project, but you've been an actor for, I mean, coming up for 30 years now. What made you want to follow a career into acting in the first place?
Really and honestly, I mean, I had both my parents were actors. So, you know, I think first I should say that it didn't seem to me like it was, you know, an extraordinary job. It wasn't like being an astronaut or something like that, which it sort of was for some of my colleagues at drama school whose parents hadn't done anything. You know, they'd come from more working class backgrounds and so they really had to kind of struggle to make the confidence leap that way. So it wasn't an unusual concept, but it wasn't really to do with them, I think. It was my drama, he wasn't really a drama teacher. He was a history teacher who directed plays at school, you know. And when I was eight, he directed me in a play. And I just literally thought that this was the best and most fun thing to do. And I said to myself when I was eight, this is what you're going to do. This is what you should do. Because, you know, getting dressed up and pretending to be other people just seems such a laugh to me. You know, and we had a really nice group of kids doing the play as well. So we had a really good time together. And he was just a really good and interesting director. So it's a teacher that really got me into acting.
And when you get a script through, or you're interested in taking on a role, what gets you excited now after being in the industry for so long?
I don't know. It could be anything. Interesting characters, really. You know, I don't have any people say, what do you want to play a particular role? And I'm like, no, not especially. You know, different roles. I've loved doing, you know, I do love Chekhov, and I've only done one, and I would love to do more Chekhov, because I find what's so interesting about him as a writer is the complexity of the people. They are so beautifully drawn and so conflicted. It's very interesting to inhabit their lives. So yes, I suppose what attracts me to a role is a bit of complexity, you know, which is why I enjoy playing my dad, because he was a complex character and his mood would shift quite quickly, which is tremendous fun as an actor when you're going from, you know, anger to laughter to sadness in swift progression.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, that's sort of a description of Quint as well, in the sense that he is quite an intimidating presence in the film, and yet, as we mentioned, also very funny. What do you think attracted him to the role of Quint? Because obviously, I think famously there were other people in the frame as well. There was Lee Marvin was talked about, Sterling Hayden, obviously. General Jack D. Ripper from Dr. Strangelove. Your father had worked with the producer, Zanuck Brown, on The Sting. Was that part of the reason you think he took the role, or was it what was on the page?
I know he didn't want to do it, you know, as it was originally written. He wanted to do Brief Encounter, which is that, and that shows you how he wanted to, you know, alter the trajectory of his casting. You know, having played a heavy in The Sting, I think he wanted to do something completely different. But thankfully, Mary, his wife, and Virginia Shaw, his assistant at the time, persuaded him that Martha's Vineyard would be a nice place to go to. You know, and obviously they were paying well, although he didn't make money out of the film because of the tax situation and the fact that it ran over. But obviously it then allowed him to become like a $1 million star after that. You know, he was always wrestling, which is one of the aspects of the film, of the play, with trying to make money to look after his family and live to a certain standard, and artistic desires, you know.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work. If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
I think it's in the play. I hope I'm right, but do you think he had a certain dismissiveness? I think there's a line in the play where he's a little dismissive of the idea of them being in this movie. Jaws is a film about a killer shark. Did he think it was all just a bit silly?
Yes, I think he did. You know, it's certainly with early drafts of the script, he felt that it was just a, you know, and this is the thing, though, you never know what you on paper to him, it looked like it was going to be a B movie, you know, that would make money. You know, and he'd rather be working with Harold Pinter, you know, but I think afterward, you know, I think he did see, as it was going on, he did see a lot in Steven Spielberg, and they went bankrupt, and he offered to, you know, defer his wages in order for Steven to finish the film, because I think he thought that Steven had a lot of talent. And when it was released, I think he was proud of it. He realized, I mean, because this is the other thing you don't know, you know, John Williams' score, Werner Fields' wonderful editing, you know, all these things, you know, all you do at the end of the day is see these very sort of, you know, bumpy, you know, rough, you know, sequences called dailies at the end of, you know, the day. And, you know, a lot of actors would say that they genuinely don't know how good or bad a film is going to be. It's you know, it's no sure thing. And I think that Robert felt that it was going to be poor, but was delighted to realize at the end what the result was, you know.
Yeah, I think it's some actors don't even watch dailies because it can put them off their game, because it is so non-representative of what the final product will be. And the crux of The Shark Is Broken, it really focuses in on one of the most famous elements behind the scenes of Jaws, which was the relationship of your father and Richard Dreyfuss. Did you meet Richard when you were on set as a six-year-old? Did you even, as a child, I don't imagine you picked up on any tension that was there.
No, I didn't meet either of the other two. And not to my memory, anyway. I met Richard later in life, so I didn't know that they had this difficulty until I was an adult.
Yeah. And you found out when you met Richard
I didn't even then. I mean, I found out after I suppose I did. When I met Richard, I introduced myself as Robert's son, which I would never do, but I just felt in this circumstance it was, okay, because I just assumed that Richard would be delighted to see me. And I don't think he was particularly, you know, I think that he hadn't processed at that point the, you know, the a little bit of trauma that he had with Robert. I mean, I think he has now. It's interesting to see him in interviews talking about it now, and he seems to be quite sort of wise and at peace, and has sort of processed, you know, the puzzle, because it wasn't all bad. It was mixed messages. You know, and I think my father's intention, it's very hard to know. I think my father's intention was to kind of school him in how to be a man or a male actor, and possibly also to get a good performance out of him. But I think that was secondary. You know, so complex relationship the two of them had, I think. I have huge admiration for Richard, by the way. I've always thought he is a wonderful actor. So that was another thing that made me slightly pause, you know, before writing this. I mean, you know, not least, I love Jaws, and I didn't want to write something that would, you know, in any way cheapen that, you know.
And did you think at the time I should contact Richard, or that would introduce a whole other realm of issues? Then you'd maybe end up having to run every aspect of a play through someone once you open those floodgates, as it were.
I think Joseph and me felt we wanted to have artistic freedom to, to explore the story. So, you know, we didn't contact him, but I mean, I'm sure he would be far too busy to respond to us anyway.
And I do think, I think you're right. I watched an interview that he did. It was on an Irish chat show. I think it's on YouTube, where he talks at length about the relationship he had with your father on Jaws. And he seems almost regretful slightly that it went the way it did. And I mean, to use your phrase, he seems to be at peace with it.
Yeah, I think he is. Yeah, which is admirable as well, because it'd be very easy to, I think, to bear a grudge there.
And I think if I'm right, and it is actually, it's a moment that you've captured wonderfully in the play, but by all accounts, stories from the set of Jaws, and again, these are all stories, some of them are hearsay, some of them seem to carry more weight than others, that it really reached a pinnacle of difficulty when your father was asking for help aboard the Orca, and he was holding a drink in his hand, and Richard took the drink from him and dropped it over the side. And by all accounts, there was an audible gasp from the crew, who were just like, oh, you did not want to do that.
Yeah. Yes, he did. Yeah. And so we recreate something like that. Yeah, that's an incendiary moment. I mean, my father was an alcoholic as well. So, I mean, I think that adds the extra element to it. But I do think that Robert saw that Richard had a lot of potential and was a good actor. Mm. Otherwise, I don't think he would have spent so much time, you know, I don't think he would have bothered with him so much. I think the three of them, and that's Roy as well, which is why it's so crucial, why I found it so interesting, is that they are three very different people. Mm-hmm. You know, I think Robert was incredibly confident and fearless and intellectual to some degree. They were all very intelligent, I would say that. But... you know, and Richard was a bit more sort of neurotic to some degree and sort of slightly self-obsessed. Certainly that's what Robert felt. Hmm. And Roy was, you know, to us, for as far as I can see, was the sort of steady hand, you know, the one who... out of the three of them, because Roy didn't have an easy childhood. Roy had a very difficult childhood, but he somehow managed to process all of that and come out the other end into this rather wonderful, you know, even-handed grown-up.
I was going to ask, because while your father and Richard and their relationship on set is really well documented, there's kind of less written about Roy Scheider.
I think he was quite a private man. And so in terms of him talking about himself, he doesn't want to volunteer up enormous amounts of information anyway. But you do get a glimpse into his life in the play.
And I do believe that... you mentioned Steven Spielberg meeting him. He's given it his blessing. How did you find out that he was approving, I guess, of what you were doing with the play?
Well, I mean, I don't 100% know what his feeling is either way, but I do know that he was, you know, happy enough to give permission for the Indianapolis speech because Amblin owned the script.
And if I'm right in thinking, you've met Steven Spielberg at the Golden Globes, and what he said to you does make me smile. Did he say, if I ever make the prequel, I'd like you to play Quint?
Something along those lines. I can't remember exactly what he said.
Okay.
It was, you know, but I think he was being amusing. You know, he was being kind and sweet and...
Yeah,
but that would have been bad. And I mean, you know, what's great with Steven is he doesn't need to make sequels, does he? I mean, has he made sequels?
He made The Lost World. I think that's his only sequel. He followed up Jurassic Park with The Lost World, but that's it. Okay. That's it.
Generally speaking, he's he's more interested in conquering new territory.
And it's nice that he sort of, I mean, gave permission, or through Amblin gave permission, however that played out, for the play, because he's very protective of Jaws. I mean, you hear these rumblings every so often from within the bowels of Universal going, oh, a remake of Jaws, we're going to remake Jaws. And he, every time it sort of rears its head, he's very clear that Jaws should not be remade.
Well, bless him. I think that's wonderful. I mean, you know, I'm very happy, and I think Jaws fans are very happy that it hasn't been.
Hmm. I mean, you just couldn't. I mean, what would you do? CGI sharks? I mean, I just, and not even the shark. I mean, the relationship, like you said yourself, between Roy Richard and your father, it's lightning in a bottle, as far as I'm concerned.
I mean, of course, I think it will be remade.
Do you really?
No, I think so, because, you know, I love Steven's attitude, but I believe that it'll have a limitation, you know, that at some point the script will be beyond copyright. You know, I think it's 75 years after. So perhaps I hope Carl Gottlieb lives for 150 years or whatever, but,
I was just doing the same math.
5 years after that, it'll be up for grabs.
Yeah, I was just trying to work out in my head. I was like, will I still be here at that point? Because I'm not sure I want to see that. It is, you've no doubt heard it a lot. It is uncanny when you first come out on stage as Quint, as your father in the play. You not only look so much like him, but, you know, the accent, the costume, the fact that you're on the set of the Orca. Are you aware that there's a kind of, I mean, where I was sitting, there was almost an audible gasp from the audience when you appear. Are you aware of the atmosphere in the room sort of changing and people going, wow?
No, someone else said this. I'm not aware of that. I mean, I am aware that I believe I am Roberts. I mean, you tend to obviously try and get that feeling with every character you play, but I feel that there's a shorthand between us, because, you know, father and son, you know, you feel that you are genetically, you know, similar. And I know that my voice and my face are, you know, right for the role. So, you know, and I feel I've also, you know, been studying him my whole life to some degree. So it feels right, but I don't know what the perception is.
I mean, I can only speak personally, but to be completely candid, there's a part of me where when you're performing the Indianapolis speech, it was almost like watching your father performing the Indianapolis speech live on stage, like pulled straight from the film and put on stage. Does that make sense? It was a very strange moment.
Well, I'm very happy, you know.
I did want to ask, what's it like, not so much playing Quint, but playing your father on stage and that experience, which I think is quite unique?
I don't know how to describe it, really. It's he's a great character. You know, they always used to say as well that as an actor, when you're playing a character, you have to like them, you know, even if they're a, you know, murderer or whatever. Well, that's very easy for me. You know, I adored my father, so that's easy. And, you know, like I say, he was very interesting. And what's the most liberating thing is, because I'm quite, you know, oddly, I feel, you know, in life when I'm walking around, I feel quite shy and restrained. He was fearless and he wasn't frightened of anything, I don't think. That's a nice aspect to feel. You know, I haven't got the confidence that he had, and it's liberating to be playing somebody that free and confident.
And what was he like? Like, what are your memories of him when, obviously, outside of Jaws, as a family, as your dad and you're his son at home?
Very loving dad, very funny. I mean, obviously, you didn't want to, you know, argue with him, but he was extremely affectionate, loved children, you know, and loved playing. So the time we did, obviously, he was working a lot, but the time we did have with him was great fun. I remember one time where I don't think I've told this story. We were watching Earthquake on television, which is a sort of Charlton Heston B movie.
Yeah.
And we were both in bed together in our pajamas watching this television film. And I think I accidentally pushed a button on the wall. Anyway, as we were watching it, all of a sudden the Beverly Hills police burst into our room with guns, you know, pointing at me and Dad. Because I'd obviously pushed, it was quite an expensive house we were renting, and it had an emergency button that I accidentally pushed, which was only to be used in case of burglary or whatever. But yeah, we were both quite that. I did see him look quite alarmed at that point. That was the only time I ever saw him looking nervous.
You found the limit of his fearlessness. In terms of, I just want to share one story with you, which was a big moment for me. It's quite a weird story. I'll make it quick, but I was on the set of a movie called The Equalizer 2, starring Denzel Washington. And I was talking to the props guys, and they were showing me a table full of the weapons that Denzel was going to use in the climax to the movie. And they handed me one weapon, and they went, "Do you know what that is?" And I was like, "No, I don't." And they went, "That is Quint's harpoon gun from Jaws." And I went, "Wow, wait, the actual one?" And they were like, "Yep." And I got so excited, I could not believe that I was holding Quint's harpoon gun. So it's, you know, the actual harpoon gun is still sort of there in the props world of Hollywood, still making its way from movie to movie.
Well, have you seen the new museum in Los Angeles to movies?
Yeah, the Academy's museum. Yeah, I haven't seen it, but yeah, I'm aware of it, yeah.
Well, I think Bruce is one of the main features as you walk in. Oh. So I'm looking forward to wandering around there one day.
Yes. Just to go back to playing your father, obviously he passed when you were 8 years old. Is it, what's the word? Is it cathartic? Is it slightly therapeutic playing him and, I don't know, going through some of your memories of him or potentially going through some of the issues that he had at the time? How does that play? Because I guess from my angle, there are moments when you're watching it going, this is a really, really personal performance.
You know, writing it was cathartic, I think, and you know, finding out more about what made him tick, because there's a lot of, you know, opinion in there that we've pieced together from other, you know, from things that didn't happen during Jaws, but just things that he believed. So that was very cathartic and interesting. In terms of it being personal, you know, I don't know. I mean, a lot of art is personal, but you also feel it's universal. I mean, I know, you know, not everybody obviously has parents who do the same, but a lot of people have parents who they've lost, like, so. And my father, you know, lost his father when he was 12. So, you know, And a lot of people, that's happened to, well, you know, a lot of people have written to me and talked to me about losing their a parent early. Hmm. So that's a sort of universal theme to some degree. I do find that very interesting perspective, you know, because you tend to sort of to think about your grief as being only you. But everyone grieves, you know, and you know, listening to my father talking about losing his father somehow makes it, I don't know why, but it somehow makes it easier, you know. And I suppose I feel like I'm turning sadness into a story, which is, you know, cathartic. It feels like it is, you know, you're sort of recycling something and using it to be stimulating for other people. Hmm.
Just to clarify something that we talked about earlier, obviously you've seen Jaws. You watched it. Were you quite young when you watched it?
I think I was probably 7, 8.
How are you with
this? It was before my dad died, you know.
Oh, did you watch it together?
I don't know. I can't remember who I watched it with. All I can remember is being terrified, you know.
Yeah. You and me both. I have 2 years on you, though. I have. I was 5 when I watched it, and it. Wow. I have no relationship with the sea. The sea is just one giant pool of death, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. I understand.
I don't get me wrong. I love sharks. You know, I do love sharks, and you know, I mean, obviously, Jaws demonized sharks for a generation, but yeah, I failed my 25-meter swimming certificate because I swore there was a shark in the swimming pool and climbed out. Have you had any experiences of being in water and going, nope?
Well, I didn't swim for I would say at least 2 years, even in a swimming pool. No, I had no interest. It was that shot from underneath, that kind of sealed it for me. It was just like, right, okay, you're just, you know, a sandwich for somebody, you know, or something.
Yeah, well, that's it, isn't it? I did try and analyze this fear, and I think it is, it's about the unknown. It's about, you know, you watch those videos of great white sharks breaching at, you know, 60 miles an hour or whatever, and you're like, well, you know, you just never see it coming, and just to not know that that isn't below you is the scary thing. I couldn't have bubbles in the bath for a while because I needed to see the bottom. That's right. Where I was.
Yeah. No, I'm with you.
I have a shark tattooed on my wrist to remind myself if I ever get drunk on a beach, not to think it's a good idea to go in the sea because that's where the sharks are.
Yeah. I mean, it's obviously very unfair, isn't it? I mean, I think a lot of shark charities have latched onto Jaws, and and they kind of flip it round, don't they? They, you know, because the poor sharks. I mean, I think Stephen's very. I mean, that would probably be his only regret.
Yeah.
That you know, he didn't paint sharks in a great light.
Well, it's a funny one, isn't it? I just don't think people knew that much about sharks at the time, because I remember the famous Zanuck and Brown, the producers, before they decided to build a shark, they investigated getting someone to train a great white shark. And they were like, this is what we need. We need the shark to be tame enough to do close-up work with a stunt double. So
is that true? I've never known whether that was true or rumor.
I mean, you kind of want it to be true because it smacks of that kind of Hollywood, we'll just get a shark attitude, like from two big shark producers. But yeah, I don't know. I do know.
I mean, they probably should have got, you know, like 3 dolphins and put a suit around the dolphins.
Now, you see, that would be wonderful. The bit of trivia I do know is true is, I can't remember where I found this bit out, that Steven Spielberg actually wanted to end Jaws as Brody and Hooper were paddling back to shore with a school of shark fins appearing on the horizon heading towards them. And Richard Zanuck had to go, Steven, there are just a million reasons why that is not a good idea.
Right. My God, never heard that one.
I've spent too much time on the internet, to be quite honest, Ian. So my favourite bit of trivia, though, of all of them, is you've never watched the Jaws sequels.
I tried. But, yeah. I can't be disparaging about them because I haven't watched them, put it that way.
As a kid, I was so taken with Jaws that I've got time for Jaws 2 and even Jaws 3D. It's the fourth one where things go off the rails. Ian, it has been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Once again, as I start the interview, congratulations on a fantastic play. Would you, complete fairy tale world, blank canvas, dream factory, I would love to see this make its way onto the cinema screen. Fairy tale land, would you like to see a similar thing?
Possibly. It's just a question of who would be doing it, you know, because it would have to be the right people. So I don't know is the answer.
But it, okay. I'm not gonna press the point, but Dream Factory.
If I could pick the people I would want to, you know, produce, direct, etc., then yes, I think I would. But at the moment, you know, I'm just really trying to focus on making the play a success and for people to enjoy it as a theatrical experience. Mm. And not get too ahead of myself.
Well, I mean, you've got till, I'm right in thinking it's the 13th of February next year. That's when the run's been extended to.
Yes, that's right.
And then, I mean, not to get ahead of yourself, but are there plans to take it on tour?
We haven't discussed it yet. We will probably, I think, sit down after New Year's Eve. Mm. and discuss what the future will be. There will be a future for the play, you know, but I don't know where and when.
That's, I can see it having a great future. I can't recommend it enough. I had a great time. And like I said, I think Jaws and non-Jaws fans alike will really, really enjoy it. Congratulations. It's on at the Ambassador's Theatre. Ian, farewell and adieu.
Thank you.
I toyed with that sign off and there's a part of me that hates myself for doing it, but there you go. It just happened, right?
No, that's very apt.
Have a great rest of your day and have a great performance tonight. Thanks for your time, mate.
Thanks very much, Alex. Cheers.
Cheers.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hello, Alex Zane here. Thank you for choosing to listen to Just the Facts. And while you can still enjoy these episodes forever, you might want to check out our brand new show, A Trip to the Movies, where each week a different famous film fan curates their perfect night out at the cinema, picking what snacks they'd eat, where they'd sit, who they'd go with, and of course, what movies they'd screen. If you love cinema as much as we do, search A Trip to the Movies with Alex Zane or head to our socials at Trip to Movies Pod. That's at Trip to Movies Pod to find out more.